This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we recognize the 51st anniversary of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam.
Did this set a precedent for future American military action, or did it set a precedent for anti-war activists?
We speak with author Victor Wallace about his new book, Democracy Denied.
The book's based on 5 lectures that he gave to Chinese students, but I think all American students and all Americans, period, should read this book, Democracy Denied.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The aggressiveness of the United States of America's war machine has killed 500,000 people since 9/11, caused millions of people to be displaced and homeless, and all of this at a cost of some $6 trillion. President Trump has said that all options are on the table regarding sending troops to Venezuela. His national security advisor, John Bolton, said that Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua are part of the troika of tyranny and in the U.S. gun sights. After first promising to withdraw troops from Syria, Trump has reversed himself. Troops are still fighting in Afghanistan after 19 years. Iran remains the ultimate target in the Middle East. How did our country get to this state? What was done 50 years ago in the Vietnam era by millions of American citizens, which helped end, in 1975, the American War in that country? What can be done now? March 18th marks the 51st anniversary of the infamous My Lai massacre in Vietnam. There, American troops murdered 504 Vietnamese women, old men, children, and babies. It marked a turning point in the American people's revulsion and consequent mobilization against the war. We speak today with former Navy Lieutenant Susan Schnall of the Veterans for Peace. She became famous in 1968 when she dropped anti-war leaflets from an airplane on Navy ships in San Francisco Bay. We speak as well with Vets for Peace artist Mac McDermott. He's responsible for installing the My Lai Massacre exhibit in New York City and having a tour around the country. It commemorates the My Lai Massacre. The exhibit creates a sacred space where participants encounter a troubling and painful look at U.S. behavior in Vietnam during the American War. Susan and Mac, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
It's very good to have you here. We're so appreciative of the work that you're doing for Vets for Peace. Susan or Mac, President Eisenhower said in 1954, when the United States replaced the French colonial troops in Vietnam, that the area was rich in rice and rubber, tin and tungsten. And then President Lyndon Johnson, who, like his predecessors, prosecuted the war, said that unless the USA captured Vietnam, the area was vulnerable to any yellow dwarf with a pocket knife. Susan and Mac, how did you come to oppose the war in Vietnam?
My opposition to war started very, very early. My father was a Marine in the Second World War, and he was killed on the beachhead in Guam in 1944. So I grew up for thinking about issues about peace. I joined the United States Navy as a nurse in 1966 and thought that I would be taking care of the folks, the GIs who were wounded in Vietnam, and healing the wounds of war and being able to get them back into their regular life and regular function. And what I found is young men returning from war with this terrible anger and hatred toward people who looked different from them, who were different from them. And I just thought, you know, we need to stop this war, and we need to stop and heal ourselves and understand that because people may look different from us, they're still human beings. And I found the American war in Vietnam to be dehumanizing for our own troops, and that these young men became killers and murderers in a country 8,000 miles away from us.
Mac and Susan, why should we remember specifically the My Lai massacre? And why remember the 2 million civilians that we killed in the Vietnam War?
I think it's really important. We're, as a chapter, a Chicago chapter of Veterans for Peace, we're a member of something called Sites of Conscience. And Sites of Conscience is a coalition of 200 organizations worldwide that look at atrocities, human rights issues. They really basically talk about why is it important to remember, and they have a sort of a process that they invite their sites to use that we've used in the exhibit. And it basically goes something like this. It's really important to remember and to own sites and your own atrocities, your own human rights violations. And also, though, that's not enough. That just honoring the victims is not enough. That you need to really work to learn from that experience. What did you do? How did this happen? What went on? And then you have to help people through dialogue and interaction to move to a renewed commitment to peace and social justice. So it's important to learn from the past, to own up to what you've done, to see how it extends into the future, and to see what you can do about that, those issues, now.
Just a quick extension of that. Some of us feel that Vietnam, Southeast Asia conflict laid the groundwork for the future American military incursions all over the world, and that if you can justify the United States going into Southeast Asia, you can justify our troops being in 80 different places in the world today. So we have to remember what happened in Vietnam, the fact that this was an internal struggle that the United States invaded, and that we continue to do that. My Lai in particular is important for us to remember, to understand that all of us who may have allowed that to happen are responsible for healing the wounds of war, and that we need to understand where the United States government is, where our military is, and also understand what's happening today inside the United States.
Mac, as an artist and associate member of Chicago Veterans for Peace, what drove you to develop the My Lai Memorial exhibit and initiate a nationwide tour with this?
Well, Heidi, I came of age during the Vietnam War, and as I was graduating from college, I had to make some decisions because the draft was looming and the chances of going to Vietnam were great. So I did some reading. I read Jonathan Schell's articles in The New Yorker, and I realized, based on what was happening to civilians in Vietnam and how we were waging war there, I couldn't go. So I was privileged enough to get out of the war, get out of the draft by going to graduate school and then becoming a teacher, which gave me a deferment. But I've always been just heartbroken about what we did in Vietnam and the fact that we don't pay much attention in the wars that we're involved in. We go to wars in other people's countries where people live and are raising families, but we spend little energy thinking about what life was like for them in living in a war zone. And then as I joined Veterans for Peace, I moved to Chicago, I heard the Pentagon was going to spend $63 million in an effort to really glorify the war and increase military recruitment. And I just felt like somebody needed to get involved and do a counter-narrative of some kind and really look at this war from the viewpoint of the people who tried living in the war zone, especially in those northern provinces. And I just thought I needed to do something, and I just thought, well, maybe I can make an exhibit and I could take some of the art that I've used to help people deal with these kinds of issues and create an exhibit and just tour the United States. I would just do this. So that's how it got started. It's a very personal thing to really honor not just, you know, our veterans, which we do a lot of work on in this country, but really to honor the people who have to live through our wars. And we killed 2 million civilians in the course of the war.
The My Lai Massacre took place in March of 1968, but was covered up by the Army for 18 months. Who was responsible for the cover-up? How was the massacre exposed? And who was ultimately held accountable for it?
Well, it's really interesting. It It was, of course, covered up. It wasn't supposed to get out. There were military commanders, three of them, circling in helicopters above Mylai while the massacre was happening. But there was a guy in a helicopter named Glenn Thompson with his crew, and he saw what was happening, and he actually landed his helicopter. He worked to save some of the civilians, and he reported the massacre, and the cover-up began as soon as actually he got on the radio in his helicopter, and he said, what is going on down there? They're killing civilians. It shouldn't happen. But like many systems, and this is the important thing to learn about from Mylai and from the Vietnam War, you get a system, a militaristic kind of system, where people are following orders. They're making their higher-ups look good. They close ranks when there's any questions about what's going on, any challenges to what's happening. And so the army was able to make sure that no word of this massacre really got out for 18 months. They did a very good job of covering it up. And then they did have an investigation, and Seymour Hersh got wind of a guy named Lieutenant Kelly, who was being charged with the murder of civilians. And he actually, with very diligent work crisscrossing the country, talking to the veterans who were involved, who were willing to speak about this, he uncovered the massacre, the details of the massacre. And also a young Army enlisted man, Ron Ridenour, had actually talked and listened to some of the guys from Charlie Company who were involved in the massacre, and he wrote a letter to congressmen, to senators, to the Army, asking for investigation, and that really pushed things along as well.
I think it's really important to understand that Mylai was not an isolated incident, that we know of several similar massacres. And I think what really opened my eyes to this was when I was working on one of the Navy units, and I had a young patient who was about 19 years old at the time. And he told me his experience of rounding up Vietnamese villagers, women and children. And he said to me, we should be able to kill them all. They're all our enemies. It was an attitude that I had never heard before. And that was a huge turning point for me when I just said, we need to do something. We need to stop this. And some of your listeners may be familiar with Nick Turse's work, Kill Anything That Moves, where he talks about multiple massacres similar to what happened at Mylai.
Yeah, I remember reading in Seymour Hersh's memoir when he went out to Indiana to try to find Lieutenant Kelly, and he met his mother. And his mother told Hersh, I gave the Army my son, and they sent me back a murderer.
Yes, actually, Michael, that wasn't Callie's mom. Yeah, it was, what was his first name?
I don't remember. Last name was Medlow.
Yeah. He was the one casualty. He had stepped on a mine and blown his foot off and been sent home. And Paul Medlow, his name is, he was willing to talk with Hersh, and he was willing to go on national TV and talk about it. And it's true, when Hersh arrived at the farmhouse door, Mrs. Medlow, Myrtle Medlow, came out and said that exact thing, that I sent them a good boy and they sent me back a murderer.
In the recent Ken Burns film on Vietnam, he starts off declaring that the war was a mistake, and it was started and carried on by well-meaning people. What was your reaction, Susan and Mac, to that initial statement in the Ken Burns film, which has become the official story of the Vietnam War?
Our reaction, certainly in Veterans for Peace, was one of outrage, because that was the first installment of an 18-part or an 18-hour series. What it did was to set the audience up to think, oh yes, this was all a mistake and everybody involved in it were good people with good intentions. The issue is, and what you see in some of the following sequences, is President Kennedy, President Johnson, and President Nixon continuing to send American troops, thousands and thousands of American troops, to Southeast Asia to continue to fight this war because they wanted to be reelected. It's just astounding that you throw human lives and you destroy human lives because you want to be elected president of the United States. So my reaction and that of of my friends and Veterans for Peace was absolute outrage. And the end of the series continues to support that statement.
Susan, you participated in one of the most dramatic anti-war actions of the era. Can you tell us about it, please?
I just want to restate what drove me to this action was this absolute certainty that the war had to end and that the destruction of lives had to end. I had seen on the news that the United States Air Force was dropping flyers in hamlets in the southern part of Vietnam, urging the Vietnamese to go to these protected areas so that they would not be bombed or they would not be sprayed with Agent Orange. And I kept thinking, my goodness, if the United States could do this to a country 8,000 miles away, why can't those of us who are for peace drop flyers announcing this GI and Veterans March for Peace in San Francisco on March 18, 1968? Why couldn't we drop flyers announcing our demonstration for peace on military installations in the Bay Area? I had a friend who was a pilot, and we filled this small one-engine plane with flyers announcing the demonstration. We dropped them on Oak Knoll Hospital, which is where I was working, on Treasure Island, on Yerba Buena Island, on the Presidio, which was an Army installation in San Francisco. And then we flew into Alameda Naval Air Station because the USS Ranger, an aircraft carrier, was docked there. And we dropped our flyers on the aircraft carrier. And then we had a press conference and said, we are in the military. We oppose United States military forces in Southeast Asia, and we believe the war needs to stop. But it didn't.
It didn't. But what you did had a rippling effect, because eventually the American citizens and the soldiers who are part of American families turned against the war. And at the end, American soldiers refused to fight. And I think the main reason was that the Vietnamese were so steadfast. But the other reason was that the American soldiers just refused to fight. And that's when the United States leadership pulled out.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to state over and over again that the Vietnamese won their long battle and struggle against the United States. Those of us who worked in the anti-war movement and the peace movement helped turn American opinion against the war. And no question that when the troops turned against the war and they refused to fight and they went AWOL and they left and went to Canada and to Sweden, that had an enormous impact on both the morale in the military and also the opinion of Americans in this country who said, oh my goodness, you know, if American veterans are against this war, there has to be something. They have to be right about this.
Yeah, and the United States government has learned its lesson from that. They don't like to put troops on the ground. They'd rather do it by drone. Susan and Mac, tell us about Vets for Peace. How did you two get active in it? What does Vets for Peace do?
I joined Veterans for Peace. I went to Vietnam about 10 years ago, and while I was there, I visited children in Tadu Hospital, the children who have been impacted by Agent Orange dioxin, and saw children born with birth defects that were unimaginable to me and that I had never seen in 50 years of taking care of people in this country, and learned that their parents had been sprayed with the Agent Orange dioxin, the pesticide that was, or herbicide that was used to destroy crops and mangrove forests. And I got active in working on the issue of Agent Orange and being able to get services for both American servicemen and their children who were harmed by the Agent Orange dioxin, as well as for the Vietnamese, and to help get the land that remains contaminated, to have it cleaned up. One of the projects I worked on was connected with Veterans for Peace. So I became a member of Veterans for Peace, working specifically on the issue of Agent Orange dioxin. Over the past 10, 12 years, our chapter in New York City has also become involved in the attempts of the United States government, and specifically under Trump, to privatize the VA, because we want to maintain the VA as a public institution accountable to those who use it and to the public. One of our other major issues is move the money. We have a resolution in the New York City Council that says move the money from military spending to domestic spending, to taking care of people with social issues, of education, of social needs. The other issue is the one on Agent Orange dioxin. Right now we have legislation in front of the House of Representatives, H.R. 334, that requires the United States to provide services to the children of American male veterans, because we still do not recognize that those children were born with birth defects as a result of their dad's service, to be able to provide services to the Vietnamese and to clean up those areas of Vietnam that remain contaminated. So in New York, we have these projects, and we're working with Mac McDevitt on bringing the Mielai Project to New York to have people come and learn about what happened all those years ago that continues to have an impact on people today.
Mac, speaking of the exhibit, can you describe what it's like and what you hope people will come away and take from it?
Sure, Heidi. The exhibit is both informational and it is also humanly interactive. In terms of, we've got 44 informational panels, and we really start out with who were these people, these Vietnamese? What was their life like, the farmers who lived in these northern provinces? Because if you don't understand their life and who they were, even a little bit, you have no sense of what they really lost. And then there's a whole set of panels about the Mielai massacre, told as much as possible using the voices of the Vietnamese survivors who lived through that massacre. Very powerful stories. Mothers who stuffed their children deep down under them in the piles of bodies and took the bullets so those children could survive. And then there's the many Mielais. There's a set of panels really about how did we manage to kill 2 million civilians over a 10-year period? What were our policies, our free fire zones that we established, the racism where we were calling all Vietnamese gooks, for instance, and how that played into this really what was a Holocaust, especially for the Vietnamese living up in those northern provinces of South Vietnam. And then there's just what Susan was talking about. There's information panels about the lasting legacy of the war, the unexploded ordnance, the environmental damage, Agent Orange. And then there's a set of panels that say basically, did we learn from our experience in Vietnam, or did we use this as a model as we went ahead and invaded other countries and kicked down doors and were perceived as an invading army? Then there's an area around taking action. About organizations that are, because once you have all this, then the question is, well, what can you do, you know? And so organizations that are working to speak truth to power, organizations that are working at remediation in Vietnam, or organizations that are working for social justice. And so that's the more informational part. And then we think of the people who come to the exhibit not as visitors, but kind of as participants. They're often very deeply moved by what they've read and what they've experienced. So there's a memorial altar for them to recognize groups of people or people who've been impacted by violence. There are these sculptural collages that I've developed as an artist where people sit and make block collages using elements like the picture of the women and children at Mielai just before they were shot and an American flag T-shirt design where I basically say, how do you put these two things together? How do you put together your feelings about the flag and whatever feelings are tied up in that, and then whatever feelings happen as you look at these women and children who were shot in the name of the flag? And then people talk because they can tell you what their artwork is saying. Some just really strong, amazing dialogue and connection with people, a couple of collages like that. People write in the journal. We take pictures of their collages. So all the things that the participants have added to the exhibit then travel with the exhibit. So it grows as we go. So it's a very powerful experience, both for me and the mentors. We always have mentors there, Veterans for Peace or Peace and Justice people. And it turns out to be a very powerful experience for people who attend, who all have a story of some kind about either Vietnam, about a brother who died in Vietnam, about police brutality and violence in the streets of Chicago, who take this experience and they bring it into their lives right now.
Susan, where will this be held in New York, and is it going to be available in other parts of the country?
In New York, the exhibits start showing on Friday, March 22nd through March 24th. We will have an opening at 7 o'clock on March 22nd, and it will involve representatives from the mission to the United Nations from Vietnam. It will include the founder of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, Jan Barry, Doug Hostetter, who served as a conscientious objector for 3 years in Vietnam, will also be there and speak, and J.J. Johnson, who spent 2.5 years at Fort Leavenworth as an active duty soldier who refused orders to go to Vietnam, will be there to speak. It's at the Quaker Meeting House, 15 Rutherford Place. And for those of you who may not know where it is, Rutherford Place is between 2nd and 3rd Avenue and 15th and 16th Street. So the exhibit will be showing from Friday, March 22nd through Sunday, March 24th. I'd like to just quickly mention that on Saturday, March 23rd at 12 noon, we have an extraordinary panel of speakers. Jan Barry will be part of the panel of speakers. It will also include Bill Earhart, who is a renowned poet and author who has written about his experiences. Mac Bica, who is also an author and professor at the School of Visual Arts, and J.J. Johnson. We'll be sending out information, but Chapter 34 New York City Veterans for Peace has a Facebook page, and the information about the program and the exhibit is on that Facebook page.
Susan, you were recently in Vietnam. What'd you go there for? Tell us what it was like.
Last year, I joined a group from Veterans for Peace that traveled through different parts of Vietnam. I went to Vietnam with my daughter. We went to My Lai to commemorate the 50th commemoration of the massacre in My Lai. It was, as I said, it was a group of from Veterans for Peace. We were about 40, 45 people. We went to what the Vietnam has established as a peace park. But it was also to be there to meet with some of the survivors of the My Lai massacre and to talk about what had occurred. We met with Mr. Cong, who was 11 years old at the time of the massacre, who, along with his four siblings and his mom, went into, it was kind of the cellar, a small dugout in their hooch. The American GIs threw a grenade in. And all of his family, excluding his father, who was out in the field, were blown to bits, except for Mr. Cong, who was 11 years old. What was so inspiring about him is that he told us that life continues and that today he has a family. And he wanted us American veterans to understand that the Vietnamese, and I don't want to say that everybody is ready to forgive, but that there is an understanding that it was the United States government, not the American people, right, that caused that terrible destruction in Vietnam. We knew had been Ho Chi Minh's standard explanation for what happened. And I knew that 50 years ago when I had met with the Vietnamese, that they said over and over again, it's the American government, it's not the American people that are our enemies. Part of the ceremony included commemorating a new peace temple where the spirits from My Lai come to rest. But what we know of the Vietnamese culture and beliefs is that it is the descendants of the people that allow the spirits of the dead to come home and not to wander for the rest of eternity. And one of the young Vietnamese said to me, they have no descendants. The Americans killed everybody. And I said, well, we American veterans are here to hopefully help the spirits come to rest and to come back. It was an extraordinary experience. And as I said, I went there with my daughter, who knew about my involvement, but didn't understand the imperative for it until she went there and met with the Vietnamese. And she said, and now I understand.
Mac, where is the exhibit traveling to after New York?
Well, this New York City is going to be our 13th stop on this nationwide tour, which is running from, we started with the 50th anniversary on March 16th in San Diego of the massacre. And we'll run it until it was uncovered at the end of 2000. That'll be the 50th anniversary of Seymour Hersh breaking the story in 2019. So we're going to move on to Chicago, our hometown, and we'll be at the Hairpin Arts Center from June 5th through the 9th. The other one I have a definite schedule on is in Binghamton, New York, the Binghamton Veterans for Peace, November 7th and November 9th. But I continue. We're a pop-up exhibit, so we can be shown almost anywhere, libraries, churches, schools, and I'm actively recruiting hosts. I'd like to go to at least 10 cities this year again with the exhibit. And information on how to be a host and about the exhibit is at melimemorial.org under hosts.
Remind us of when and where it is here in New York City.
The exhibit is being shown at the Quaker Meeting House in New York City, 15 Rutherford Place, which is between 2nd and 3rd Avenue and 15th and 16th Street. It opens Friday, March 22nd. At 7 p.m. and will be at the Quaker Meeting House until Sunday, March 24th, and we will close at 4 o'clock on Sunday.
Susan Schnall, Mac McDivitt, thank you so much. You're the kind of warriors we like here at Law and Disorder. Thanks for being on the program. Good luck and take it easy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Heidi. Bye now.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
I got on that freight train, I tried to beat my way. Lord, that rocks and gravel, Lord, flew all in my face.
What happened, boy?
I deconductor, let me ride it blind.
What did it take?
I deconductor, let me ride it blind.
What did it say?
Lord, he shook his head, said, train ain't none of mine.
The United States is unique among advanced countries in having the greatest inequality, the highest poverty rate, the highest portion of its populations imprisoned, and the highest proportion lacking health care. The leaders of the USA also evince the highest disdain for the threat of ecological disaster, and they have thrown up the most severe obstacles to universal suffrage. Victor Wallace's new book, Democracy Denied, offers a succinct history of several traits unique to this nation. The book came out of a series of lectures that he gave to Chinese students recently and presents a historically grounded perspective on these traits, including chapters on American exceptionalism, on U.S. imperialism, the trajectory of African-descended people in the United States, and the efforts to develop a socialist alternative to the dominant institutions, and the current configuration of U.S. politics. Victor Wallace is a professor in the liberal arts department at Berklee College of Music in Boston. For 20 years, he was the managing editor of the magazine Socialism and Democracy. He's the author of Red-Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism, and of many articles on topics related to environmentalism, social justice, and radical politics.
Victor Wallace, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Pleasure to join you.
Victor, this book is based on a series of lectures. Are American youth as aware as other nations are of U.S. exceptionalism? And how did we come to think of ourselves as so special?
Well, I think the slogan of exceptionalism is actually something that's touted mainly by people who are putting forward all the powerful aspects of the U.S. and its alleged commitment to democracy and so on. So I'm taking obviously a different angle on it. I would say that at the present time, more and more youth are becoming aware of the critical dimension and the ways in which the U.S. falls short of its aspirations. I mean, maybe one of the most conspicuous dimensions of this is the area of healthcare, where it's pretty well known that the U.S. has the most expensive healthcare system, at the same time the one that among industrialized countries has the least satisfactory outcomes. Another dimension that's getting to be really quite well known is the fact that we lock up a higher percentage of our population than any other country on the planet. So I think some of this is becoming well known. I don't know to what extent it's more known in other countries. In China, where I gave these lectures, there is a certain amount of sort of admiration of the United States, and especially there are a lot of Chinese students who come here with the ambitions of going to business school and making good careers for themselves in China. So there are illusions there as much as there are here. I don't know if there's any clear pattern of difference in awareness on that in that regard.
What have been the consequences of this ideology of American exceptionalism?
Well, it's provided the basis for kind of the appeal that someone like Trump makes to his base. I think that it's a kind of article of faith for those who uncritically support, especially U.S. foreign policy and U.S. actions overseas, that the U.S. is the world leader. It's doing things out of generosity. It's helping people in other countries. There's even the attitude in the military, like a military going to Iraq as though they're going to do something as a favor for the Iraqi people. I mean, that's part of the ideology. It's very influential, even though plenty of people realize that it's false.
We mentioned in the introduction that your book covers five major themes and how they shape U.S. society. In addition to American exceptionalism, you talk about imperialism, race in our country, the contours of the U.S. left, and contemporary American politics. In terms of racism, can you talk a bit about how we became a place where armed white supremacists are now parading in public and where we have a president who openly displays racism?
Well, as I try to show in the book, it's really pretty well known. I mean, this book is kind of an introduction, a primer to with a lot of stuff that's well known. But the racism does go back to the very early period of U.S. history. And the point is that through different phases of history, there have been movements against it which have won certain victories. And each time that a victory has been won, there has been a kind of reaction that has set in that has tried to take back the victory in different ways. So, for example, after the Civil War, they abolished slavery in part and restored, sort of declared in the 14th Amendment, the universal applicability of the law and so on. But then there was, of course, after the Radical Reconstruction, there was a reaction in the southern states where they, in effect, reinstalled something which is not quite slavery, but the same sort of radical division in the society. And then, of course, after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, fast forward a century later, the 1960s, the big advances based on popular movements, then again there had to be a reaction. The reaction had to take a different form. It was more a national thing rather than just confined to a single region. And then it took the form of partly the war on drugs, which was disproportionately targeting people of color, and also measures for disenfranchisement. So there were a lot of type of things that in a sense, reimposed measures that had been discredited or had been overturned in one way or another.
Let's talk about our gun problem. Can you explain some of the historical antecedents to that?
Yeah, well, the gun problem is partly a continuation of the way in which the country was formed, right? By the expansion into the territories that were inhabited by Indian nations, by making war on Mexico, and also the institution of slavery, which is sort of the origin of the slave patrols. And in all these cases, both in relation to the Indian nations and in relation to sort of escaped slaves, there would be the idea that enforcement of the status quo would be the responsibility not only of constituted authorities, but also of, in effect, deputized private citizens who were given kind of bounties or rewards or encouragement, ideological encouragement, to enforce the racist status quo. And in support of that, there was this kind of expectation that the white men would be armed. So that was a continuing thing. And then that's sort of in the background. But then at the present time, we have the imperial agenda of the United States, which requires the military training and the assumption that's accepted that there's a role to be played enforcing requirements in other countries, and that the motivation for the enforcers to carry this out is consistent with some of the traditional racist assumptions. So I guess what I'm saying generally in regard to the whole thing of mass shootings is that it's not only a question of the laws affecting the accessibility of weapons, but also a question of the ideology which gives people the sense that they have a right to have these weapons, that they have a kind of use, and that violent actions are legitimized by the example that's given at the highest levels in terms of what U.S. does in its actions around the world.
We're speaking with Victor Wallace about his just published excellent book, Democracy Denied. Victor, you write that American capitalism is bankrupt, and I'd like to ask you how you relate that to, how do you explain the right-wing surge in American society? How is that related to this bankruptcy?
Well, in a way, it's you might say it's a kind of desperation. There was a great alarm on the right in the as a result of the movements of the 1960s, which showed a kind of awakening and democratization of the country, and there was an explicit reaction against it, not only by those that we call the extreme right, but also the moderate, the middle of the road kind of sectors, which said, and I cite this famous paper by Professor Huntington, there was an excess of democracy in the 1960s in the United States, and it had to be taken back. On top of that, we have the environmental crisis, which means that there's a kind of closing down of various opportunities, the limitation of various resources, and the fear of shrinking land space, shrinking access to vital goods like water, and the response of the dominant of the capitalist class is to say not that we need to reconsider our whole way of doing things, but instead we have to assure that we ourselves, the capitalists themselves, have what they need. They can survive. They have a kind of siege mentality in this situation. Let the earth go to hell, but we can, as long as we're okay. I mean, that's in the extreme form, which in effect is what's represented by the Trump administration, which is actively dismantling or any environmental protections or any even awareness of the environmental issue. So it's a real pitched battle, because we're getting closer to the extreme point where irreversible degradation sets in. And so the conflict heats up in that setting.
Victor, I understand that you have a special interest in the issue of mass incarceration. Can you address that?
Yeah, well, on a number of planes. But first of all, my personal involvement began in the 1970s when I was in Indiana, where I taught for quite a long time And I got to know quite a few prisoners then who were sort of in and out of my classes, because I was teaching at a public university, which really had a kind of cross-section of the population. And some recently released prisoners were interested in having course on Marxist theory and that type of thing. So that was my personal involvement began that way. And it expanded greatly after I became sort of the managing editor of Socialism and Democracy in the 90s and got a letter from a prisoner, which led to contacts and further contacts like that. But in terms of the place of mass incarceration in this whole history and the sort of constellation of forces in the United States now, it was part of even a central part of the reaction that we've been talking about to the 60s, that once you had the end of legal suppression of the vote, you had to find new bases for organizing or sort of controlling the populations. At the same time that you had the reaction against this mobilization, you also had, and this is coinciding in time, the deindustrialization of the United States, which threw a lot of people out of work, created a lot more hardship, created a kind of setting in which people had to hustle for work, and that was that's where the drug economy originated. So you had all these factors combining the deindustrialization with the need to suppress and the rise of the drug economy, and then the starting the inordinate sentences, and so all that came sort of starting in the late 70s and creating this multiplication of the imprisoned population. So the U.S. was not so much out of line with other countries up until the 1970s, but since then it kind of spiked to a tremendous extent, and the prison population in a way took the place in quantitative terms of people who would otherwise have jobs or be receive some kind of welfare assistance. And of course there was a kind of the attack on welfare at the same time that that this was going on. So it's a way of controlling a population which cannot be usefully in terms of the economy put to work in the society, and that's so it's really an integral part of all these developments that we've been talking about.
Victor, I guess the ultimate question for you is, how does American capitalism endure, and what's its relationship to what we've seen now as perpetual war?
Yeah, how does it endure? Yeah, that's sort of the key question. The United States emerged from World War II as the sort of sole great power, and at that point took on the role of defending capitalism throughout the world. And because of the movements that were taking place, the drives to liberation in various parts of the world, this became ultimately a potentially military task. And you had, of course, the developments in Vietnam, first in Korea, then later in Vietnam. And the military dimension became really central after World War II. I mean, there was a whole transition. I mean, that up until World War II, the usual pattern was that after a war, there'd be a kind of reduction in the military dimension of economic activity and so on. But at the end of World War II, there was a conscious decision driven partly by economic interests to maintain and even expand the military dimension of the economy. This was part of the driving force for the U.S. Counter-revolutionary role, that it not only had an interest in limiting the progressive changes that could take place in other parts of the world, but it also had, from the what's called the military-industrial complex, an economic interest in maintaining a big military establishment. And there's a terrific book, which is not all that well known, which I always cite, by Frank Kofsky, called The Great War Scare of 1948, Harry Truman and the Great War Scare of 1948, where he documents in great detail the role of the military production companies in driving federal policy to create this kind of Red Scare, so that this was a big element in what developed after World War II. So there's the permanent Red Scare, which again takes different forms in different periods. I mean, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, this has to be transformed into kind of the counter-terrorism becomes the ideology. But there's always something. I mean, in other words, it was striking, especially the turning point after 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall and the subsequent dissolution of the Soviet Union. All the pretext for the previous military effort suddenly vanished, and some people expected that this would mean, well, finally, at last, we could turn these resources to addressing human needs. Not at all. I mean, the first thing that George Bush Sr. did was then to invade Panama and then to create the conditions, the provocations which led to the attack on Iraq, and everything that's happened since has been a kind of continuous process of warfare since then. And a lot of that ties in with this whole desperate scramble to control resources, vital resources, to the maximum extent, resources vital to the economy, even if destructive to people, thinking of petroleum here. So the continuous warfare that has raged really throughout the whole Islamic world, it happens that part of the Islamic world, kind of a ring from Nigeria to Afghanistan, is an oil-rich region, and the U.S. has been continuously involved in some kind of warfare with them, which is very much tied up with this scramble for resources.
This book, Democracy Denied, by Victor Wallace, W-A-L-L-I-S, was based on a series of lectures that you gave the Chinese students.
Victor, what would you like the new generations to take away from Democracy Denied in terms of action?
Well, I think the most important first step to take is really to educate ourselves about the power system we live in, and also to recognize the urgency of change in terms of not only all the usual things, struggles against injustice, but also the sheer struggle to survive as a species in the face of the environmental crisis, and to realize that what this requires is not the selection of one politician or another to do what we think might be the right thing. It will require the active involvement of really everyone, overwhelming numbers of people, to really create first a movement, and then also the infrastructure that will be necessary for implementing all the changes that are required in order to transform the economy, the society, our ways of our economic priorities. So this is a huge task, but I'm saying to make it manageable, we think in the first instance of just educating ourselves on the scope of the issues, and then of contributing to the formation of an independent political force in the United States, a force that's independent of the Democrat and Republican parties, which, to my mind, are quite irrevocably tied to corporate interests. These forces, I mean, there can be a whole discussion about how they relate to the existing spaces within the Democratic Party. That's an area for debate. But the independent forces have to constitute themselves in any case, and then figure out how they relate to any given campaign that's going on at a particular moment. But I think that the main thing is to develop not only the forces, but the kind of culture that corresponds to that, a culture that rejects all the forms of domination that plague us. And I mean, so I realize I'm not saying anything particularly original here, but I guess what I'm trying to underscore is the urgency of the situation and the idea, which I think is really being felt already by a lot of young people, that there's no time to lose, but we have to constitute an independent political force. And it won't be just young people, but it'll have to be, in a way, led by young people. And I'm encouraged by the fact that young people, very young people, in fact, are taking the initiative in some of these legal actions on the basis of the environment. And it's always been the case that revolutions have been led by relatively young people, but I think there's also recognition that people of every generation have to get involved.
Victor, there was a passage in your book that particularly struck me about the prevailing culture in the United States and how we've come to this point. And might you please read that for us? It's on page 68.
Yeah, referring to the present dominant culture, I say that in this culture, there is no room for the idea that every human being at the deepest level has needs and desires similar to one's own. The incapacity to recognize this gives free rein to the cruelest impulses, exemplified recently by the policy of separating refugee children from their parents. When such a mindset drives a substantial portion of a society's population, including some at the highest levels of power, it becomes a menace of global proportions.
Victor Wallace, you've just written an excellent short book called Democracy Denied. That's Wallace, W-A-L-L-I-S. We encourage our listeners to go out and get it. It really is an excellent job that you did, Victor. And Heidi and I thank you for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for your support and encouragement.
I'd like to invite you all to a panel discussion that we're having at NYU Law School on March 31st. The panel is entitled Challenges to the Left and Its Lawyers. It's based on my new book, Lawyers for the Left, in the Courts, in the Streets, and on the Air. To get tickets, you should call 516-620-3602. Repeat, 516-620-3602. Or go online at give2wbai.org. 3 o'clock Sunday, March 31st, NYU Law School. I hope to see you there.